If you have no doubt of your premises or your power and want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally express your wishes in law and sweep away all opposition. But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe, even more than they believe the very foundations of their own conduct, that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade and ideas.
That's Anthony Lewis quoting the great justice of the Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes, talking about the First Amendment. We talked to Anthony Lewis about his book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The text reads like this. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. It's one of the rights the U.S. is best known and respected for throughout the world, but it's not without controversy. How free should free expression be? Should the right to it cover hate speech? Other democracies, like Germany, don't think so. How about pornography, or tobacco advertising, or dishonest political ads, or advocating the overthrow of the government? And how far should other rights that protect free speech, like the right of journalists to maintain the confidentiality of their sources, go? All these issues have been battlegrounds for the First Amendment. And the fight has ranged back and forth between the poles of more and less freedom since the amendment was passed. My guest today, Anthony Lewis, has been writing about constitutional rights throughout his long career as a journalist. He won his first Pulitzer reporting on the U.S. government loyalty program and the firing of an employee because of it. His second Pulitzer was for his coverage of the United States Supreme Court. His book, Gideon's Trumpet, examined the court's decision to grant poor defendants the right to have an attorney, even when they couldn't afford it. His new book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, is a pithy and thought-provoking essay, he calls it a biography, about the First Amendment. At a time when constitutional rights we've taken for granted are under attack, it makes a timely contribution to our political discourse. Well, Anthony Lewis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It is my pleasure to be here.
As a journalist, you've been interested in First Amendment issues for a long time and have kind of chosen it as your beat. What first got you interested in these issues?
Well, it's probably a question of how deep you want to go. Do I have to lie down on a couch? I think for some reason I always, from childhood on, rooted for the underdog in athletic contests and life. And so it was kind of natural for me to eventually focus on the Constitution as the protection against abuse by majorities and the powerful and the government. I also always wanted to be a journalist. I mean, as far back as I remember, I was a high school editor, a college editor. So the two really combine in a focus on the First Amendment.
In your book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, you call it a biography of the First Amendment. What do you mean by a biography?
I mean that it's not just a history. It's an analysis of the amendment as it has been applied in different areas of our lives. The First Amendment has 14 rather straightforward-sounding words, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Those are the two clauses I'm concerned with. There are others about religion and so on, but there are 14 words about freedom of speech and press. And in fact, I should say but rather than and, the amendment is far from straightforward. It was added to the Constitution in 1791. Nobody claiming the protection of the amendment's right to speak or publish freely won a case in the Supreme Court until 1931. That's 140 years. And then, over the next 60 years or so, the Supreme Court applied the amendment in a vast range of circumstances. And the real meaning of the amendment has been spelled out by the courts. It's judges to whom we owe our freedom to, say, rancid speech, to print government secrets, and so on and so on.
It's had a very checkered history. I mean, 1931, even after that, there have been times when the pendulum has swung away from more free speech to less. Talk about the differing approaches or the differing ideas and even the differing extent of free speech of the First Amendment in American history. If you could kind of sum up for us a little bit of this range of views.
The amendment really came to the attention, shall we say, of the Supreme Court, which of course has the last word on these issues. During World War I, and in that war, President Wilson, who was very bad on civil liberties, had no interest in civil liberties, and proposed the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, which sent hundreds of people to prison for the most innocuous things, particularly for criticizing President Wilson. So that was a low point. And it was in that period that the first Supreme Court opinion treating free speech as a fundamental American value was published, Justice Holmes's opinion in 1919. But that was a dissent. And the court itself did not, as I said earlier, adopt that view, the view of free speech as fundamental to our values, for another dozen years. And, you know, during wars and times of tension, the court tends to fall back, to yield to majority and state oppression, and notably during the McCarthy period when the court was not very brave and upheld convictions of people for not disclosing members of the Communist Party and so on. And then afterwards, it's as if the court, along with the country, came to regret the excesses of a period of fear or war, and once again began building on the tradition, the true tradition of the First Amendment.
And this true tradition, you talk about a case that happened very early on in the 18th century with a printer, John Peter Zenger. It might surprise people to know that there was a case made against him because not because he himself authored the speech, but because he printed it. Could you talk a little bit about that case?
Back in the 18th century, printers were quite important because there were no great newspaper establishments as we think of them today, or, of course, broadcast networks. There were simply people wrote out what they wanted to say and took it to a printer, a job printer. And Zenger was one of those, a German-born printer in New York. And he printed a newspaper which was very critical of the royal governor of New York. There was no First Amendment at the time, of course. There was no United States. We're talking about the colonial period. And the printer was charged with sedition, seditious libel, criminal libel. And that happens to be an old English legal category, which had a unique and devastating feature. Truth was not a defense. Even if Zenger could prove that all the bad things said about the governor were true, that didn't help him under the law. And the judge charged the jury exactly that way. And the jury's only job was to decide whether he had printed it, which was really not in question. But the jury, called to its, courage by the lawyer for Zenger, who was a great Philadelphia lawyer named Andrew Hamilton, who said to them, ignore the law and find that for the defendant, find Zenger innocent because, in fact, what it said about the governor was true. Even though the law says that's irrelevant, free him. And the jury did.
Sedition. Many people may think that the great battles of free speech have been fought over things like obscenity or hate speech. But it seems from reading your book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, that a more common theme has, in fact, been all the way through this issue of sedition. So tell us what sedition is first.
Well, sedition is, at its heart, a activity. It may be speech or it may be something else, but very often it's speech, designed to damage or bring down the government. And it's such a loose term that people are prosecuted or have been prosecuted for seditious acts or seditious speech with very little, you know, concern for whether the speech actually did any harm. The case that is the exemplar is the case that brought the first great opinion from the Supreme Court I mentioned earlier in 1919. The case is called Abrams against the United States, and it was The facts were that a group of radicals threw pamphlets from the roof of a building in New York criticizing President Woodrow Wilson for sending troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, that was political criticism, criticism of a president's policy. You can hardly imagine anything more central to the idea of the First Amendment, freedom of speech. It was certainly James Madison would have regarded it as absolutely free, James Madison, the author of the First Amendment. But they were prosecuted under Wilson's Espionage Act and Sedition Act and convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison for throwing those pamphlets, anonymous pamphlets that Justice Holmes in his dissent called puny anonymities.
That case was the great one, the exemplar, as you say, but there were even many cases of people who just, you know, said they didn't want to buy bail bonds, you know, while they were drinking in a bar, they kind of got a little drunk and said something, and then they went to jail as well.
Those were examples I gave from the Montana Sedition Act. Most states adopted little state sedition laws, like the federal sedition law, and literally thousands of people were sent to prison for such innocent acts as the one you just described.
Now, those may seem pretty absurd, looking backwards from where we are now, but you say that the freedom of speech may be in doubt now, and specifically around this issue of sedition. Could you talk a little bit? In fact, what you say is the response to it, these sedition laws, are the political use of fear to justify repression. So that sounds more contemporary.
It does, but today we have a different problem, I think. We don't have today the classic putting people in jail because they criticize the president. We're all criticizing the president, and we don't go to jail for that reason. The fear stems from something else, and it's the expansive use of presidential power, the assertion that the president can do things without any authority from Congress, the torture of prisoners, which is certainly, from my point of view, the low point of American history, that a president should order his agents to torture prisoners. To me, it's unthinkable. The holding of people, including American citizens, in detention without trial, those are all acts that cause fear. They're not the traditional kind of punishment for what you say. They're punishment for what you may be because somebody suspects you, but you don't get a trial. You don't get any hearing. You don't have a judge look at your case. It's all done by the president and his agents, which is very scary.
And we're speaking with Anthony Lewis. He holds the James Madison Chair on First Amendment Issues at the Columbia School for Journalism. He's a journalist and author of Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. And yet people also are being thrown or put on things like the no-fly list if they do engage in what we might think of as free speech activities.
Well, they may have done nothing because they don't get any hearing. They don't know what it is they're supposed to have done. That's the worst thing about something like the no-fly list. I agree with you. It's an outrage. You just go to an airport and you can't get on a plane. Why? They don't tell you.
And also librarians who, well, maybe that's not quite a free speech issue, but, you know, actually...
It's quite close, I think.
Yeah, say something.
The library case situation arises under the Patriot Act, which authorizes the FBI to issue what are called national security letters. They can take one of those to a library and demand to know what books you read, what books you've taken out from that library. And the person they serve this piece of paper on is not allowed to tell anybody else about it or go to court or do anything except give the FBI the answer. And, of course, they don't tell you. So your reading habits are being scrutinized without your knowledge.
So it's not so much free speech, but something very akin to it, and that is access knowledge.
I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question about a conundrum that I think often surfaces around the issue of free speech, and that has to do with hate speech.
Sure.
If, for example, the Ku Klux Klan has expressed hate speech, people can argue that this can, in fact, damage a social fabric, can lead, in fact, to atrocities, or can lead to the violation of individual rights. And others argue that if you give an inch, then those who want to take away the right of free speech will then use that as precedent and use that to oppress all of us.
You have stated why being a judge is a hard job. You have to balance the very interests that you have described. Of course, there are moments when speech is so hateful and so imminently close to causing real harm that it can be punished or stopped. And the Supreme Court has laid down a formula for that, even though formulas don't always answer every case, but the formula is that you can punish speech if it calls for violation of law or revolution and intends to bring the harm about imminently and is likely to achieve that result to an audience that, shall we say, is a tinderbox, ready to go out and kill people, as in a Ku Klux Klan situation, or today, as in the example I use in the book of an imam preaching in London, which is an actual case, the need to blow up airplanes as part of jihad. And somebody from that congregation, a man named Richard Reed, actually goes out and tries to blow up an airplane. He was the shoe bomber. And then you can punish that kind of speech because it's so imminently close to doing real harm. That's the formula, but of course the facts always make it hard to fit the formula to the result.
Well, you began this interview saying that you've always been for the underdog, and I wonder if this might come into play, this issue of who is the speech for, come into play in parsing out rights that may be opposing to each other. And I'm thinking now of the Shield Law for journalists, which is another controversial issue. Two recent cases that are very different. One that actually did go to court. The other one that I know from talking with the reporter, he was afraid it would go to court. Are on the one hand, Judith Miller, she was a reporter for the New York Times, who was one of the reporters who had in her notes the name of Valerie Plame, was seen by many people as protecting the administration. And on the other hand, Eric Lichtblau, another reporter for the New York Times, who won the Pulitzer for his reporting on the warrantless wiretapping, and I spoke with him recently, and he said, you know, that he was quite fearful that he might end up spending some time in jail because he would not give up his sources when the administration was trying to find the leak that he drew on for his reporting on warrantless wiretapping. So here's my question. Well, I guess I'd like you to talk about the use of the Shield Law in these two questions, and then maybe you'll answer my question before I have to ask it.
Now, let me say first that Lichtblau is, it's not theoretical. His colleague James Risen has been subpoenaed for information on his sources for a chapter of a book he wrote on the very same thing.
That's so, right, and they actually co-wrote those
they
reports.
Co-wrote the stories. And Risen wrote a book, and he's been subpoenaed, and he faces the very issue. It's not theoretical. Well, I think when you have a reporter who is disclosing lawlessness on the part of the government, because that wiretapping was done in direct violation of a criminal statute, which said that you had to get a warrant from a special court in order to do that wiretapping, and the president simply ignored the statute or instructed his subordinates to violate the statute. I think when you're a reporter and you disclose that kind of lawlessness and abuse of power by the government, you can only get the facts from anonymous sources because nobody inside the government, a relatively small number of people, would know about that secret program, and you couldn't possibly expect one of those few who knew about it to come to you and say, Eric, here's a story, and I want you to print my name as a source because I'd like to get the glory of telling you. Nobody's going to say that because you'll be immediately fired and maybe prosecuted. So they're all going to want to say, I can only tell you this in confidence. And I think it's very important to protect the sources in that kind of case. On the other hand, in the Judith Miller case, she never actually wrote anything, so it's a rather confusing case. She just had some things in her notes. But there was, as you said, some suggestion, some implication that she was actually carrying the water of the administration on her shoulders, that she was part of became privy to an effort by Vice President Cheney and his people to smear Valerie Plame's husband because he had written a story saying that President Bush had used false information about supposed nuclear weapons in Iraq. So the reason to keep her sources secret seemed less compelling to me, and it was less compelling to the judges who passed on it.
So is this really the distinction, that basically we go back to the purpose of the freedom of speech or the laws protecting free speech and free thought?
And it's not the distinction today. First of all, you can't go to the whole law of the First Amendment. The Shield cases are very special, and they're a very controversial area of law, and they're sui generis, shall I say. The idea that you should decide Shield cases on the basis of the purpose of the publication of information without a source, a named source, is not part of the law now, not the established law, but it has been proposed by one or two judges very forcefully, and the courts have begun acting as if that should be the test. They haven't formally said so, but there's a lot of talk about that being the proper test.
And does that go to the larger issue of the purpose of free speech? Is the purpose of free speech to protect society's ability, the people's ability to speak truth to power?
That's one purpose. It's a very large purpose, and it certainly was dominant in James Madison's mind. He was acutely conscious of the danger of a majoritarian society. He was helping to introduce, for the first time in the world, a society based on representative institutions in which the people would have the ultimate sovereignty. And he was afraid that a majority of the people would be abusive and would abuse minorities and punish people with different views. He was acutely conscious of that danger. And so what you just said, speak truth to power, was a dominant motive on his part in drafting the amendment. But the amendment's been used for lots of other things, to keep free the publication of artistic works, to allow James Joyce's Ulysses to be published after years of being repressed, and so on and so on. There are many other reasons for freedom. Freedom of mind, freedom of poetry, freedom of art.
And we're talking with journalist Anthony Lewis about his book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Now, looking ahead, I guess I go back to one of my very first questions. You say that the freedom of speech is in doubt. You have studied the Supreme Court very closely. Right now, it's many decisions hang in the balance. What do you see ahead? What do you see in terms of the stakes around free speech in the next election?
Here again, I think we have to understand that there's something slightly different from freedom of speech that's preoccupying the Supreme Court today. The issues that are coming to the Supreme Court that have aroused the most controversy and the most, to me, the most important test of American values aren't free speech in the traditional sense, but they involve the right of the government to keep people prisoner without a trial, to deny them any form of judicial hearing, to deny them habeas corpus, which is the right to go to court to protest your imprisonment. And those aren't traditional free speech cases. The interesting thing historically is that freedom of speech, in the traditional sense, the kind that evoked the great dissent of Justice Holmes that I mentioned earlier, and that I might, if I get a moment, quote from, those cases are not before the court so much anymore, for a simple reason, because freedom of speech in that traditional sense has become endorsed from right to left in American society. Conservatives, just as much as liberals, favor letting people speak today. That wasn't true traditionally. Conservatives were very repressive, and all of the early cases, like the one Holmes dissented in, were cases in which conservatives kept, you know, really very innocent speech from being uttered or punished it. But today, I think there's a general agreement that it's good to let people speak out. But the issues come down to the ones about presidential power and torture and detention without trial. Those are the crucial issues, I think. And those are a very important aspect of the next election because, you know, presidents appoint Supreme Court justices and what their appointments change the law. That's our system.
And you said you had a quote from Holmes related to this.
The traditional free speech doctrine developed really starting with Holmes's opinion in the case I mentioned earlier about the radicals who threw pamphlets from the roof of a building in New York and were sent to prison for 20 years. And Holmes said, persecution for the expression of opinions seems to me perfectly logical. He's only talking about the expression of opinions, you see. If you have no doubt of your premises or your power and want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally express your wishes in law and sweep away all opposition. But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe, even more than they believe the very foundations of their own conduct, that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas. That, at any rate, is the theory of our Constitution. It is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. While that experiment is part of our system, I think that we should be eternally vigilant against attempt to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death.
Anthony Lewis, author of Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment, thanks so much for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice.
I've enjoyed it a lot, and your questions were wonderful.
Anthony Lewis holds the James Madison Chair on First Amendment Issues at the Columbia University School for Journalism.